A great big bonjour and welcome to the Good Life France podcast. I'm Janine Marsh, your host. And as you may tell from my accent, I'm not French. I'm from London, UK, but I've had a home in the far north of France, Pas-de-Calais, for 20 years. I write books about France. I'm the editor of a magazine and website about France, and I travel around France all year round, exploring and discovering more about my adopted country. Last week, I was in southwest France and Paris. Next week, I'll be in Picardy, and the week after, I'll be in the lovely city of Arras. But when I'm not travelling or writing or looking after my many animals, I have more than 50 animals, I love to chat to you on this podcast alongside my podcast partner, Olivier Geoffrey.
Bonjour tout le monde and welcome to the podcast. I'm French and I lived in England for 20 years, but now I live in lovely sunny Lyon in the far south of France, the opposite end of l'Hexagone, as we French call France, to Janine. When I'm not chatting to you, I'm a radio presenter here in Lyon and I also have my own radio station called Paris Chanson. Well, that's us. So now let's get down to business. Janine, can you please tell us what's coming up in this episode?
Well, today we're going to be talking about a man who, in his time, was one of the most powerful men in the world. He had a huge impact on French history. He had lavish tastes. He was a control freak. He loved the arts and believed himself chosen by God to rule over millions of people. You might have guessed who I'm talking about by now. It is the one and only Louis XIV, the Sun King. He was arguably one of the greatest kings of France, certainly one of the most remembered. He was also a Machiavellian puppet master whose legacy is evident in the France of today, long after its citizens disposed of his heirs.
A great topic indeed. There's a lot to say about him. He ruled for a very long time and he was a fascinating character who lived an incredible life, one of history's most iconic monarchs for sure. So let's talk Louis. The Good Life France podcast. Everything you want to know about France and more. With Janine Marsh and Olivier Geoffrey. Okay, step back with us to the 17th century France to explore the life and times of Louis XIV and discover the man behind the legend and the legacy that outlived him.
So Louis was born in 1638 into the royal house of the Bourbons. He was a much loved baby and he was called Louis Dieudonné, the God-given one, because after 23 years of marriage and four miscarriages, his parents, King Louis XIII and Queen Anne, had all but given up hope of having a healthy son. Interestingly, he was born with teeth, which was thought to be a sign of a great future. Later, he was called Louis le Grand, Louis the Great, and Louis le Roi du Soleil, the Sun King. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Little Louis became a king at just 4 years old in 1643 when his father died. He was crowned in Reims Cathedral in Champagne. Because he was so young, his mother became regent, of course, until he was ready to take over. As a chief advisor, she took a man called Cardinal Mazarin. He was not a humble man at all and loved the nice things. He was an obsessive collector of valuable things, and when he died, he was the richest man France had ever seen at that point. Anne and her advisor spent money like it was going out of fashion, and when they tried to raise more money by getting government officials to give up their wages, for 4 years, there was uproar.
What were they thinking of? Completely understandable that people went crazy over this. You can't keep taxing people and eroding their quality of life. Of course, there was pushback. So Cardinal Mazarin had his opponents arrested. Not a good move. Now, this is a potted history, of course, but all these shenanigans led to rebellion by the nobles against the monarchy, and it was known as the Fronde, a series of civil wars between 1648 and 1653. Queen Anne, she fled her home in Paris, taking little Louis with her. And for Louis, who was just 9 years old then, when it all kicked off, it was a terrifying time and it deeply affected him, giving him a lifelong desire for absolute control and shaping his approach to monarchy. It also made him not want to live in Paris.
Mazarin had a firm pair of hands on the reins of power and wasn't going to let them go if he could help it. It wasn't until he died in 1661 that Louis was able to take total control, and he vowed that from now on he would rule without a chief minister. Only he could issue orders, only he could direct policy. He was, after all, he believed, the direct representative of God who had chosen him to rule France.
He also believed that he possessed miraculous healing powers. On major holidays, he went around touching those infected with something called scrofula. Sounds horrible. It's also known as tuberculosis of the neck. Actually, it wasn't just him who thought he could cure sick people. Everyone thought he could. But actually, scrofula, although pretty horrible, couldn't be cured. But it also rarely killed. So when people didn't die after being touched by the king, they all went along with this theory that kings could cure. In 1680, Louis bestowed his royal touch on 1,600 people in one day alone. And it was said that he probably healed around 350,000 people during his reign.
Wow.
Yeah.
And he also associated himself with the Roman sun god Apollo. He felt that as the world revolved around the sun, so France revolved around him, Louis, and that's how the sun became his emblem.
Very modest. By the time Mazarin died, Louis had already been married for a year to his first cousin, Marie Theresa of Spain. He didn't love her. It was a strategic alliance organized by the cardinal, even though at that time Louis was in love with Mazarin's own niece, Maria, and had an affair with her. And Louis was married to Marie Theresa for 23 years, and in that time they had six children, although only one of them survived to become an adult. Also, during that time, he had many mistresses and many more offspring, including five children with the Duchess Louise de la Valliere, a lady in waiting to his wife, seven children with the Marquise de Montespan. Actually, no one knows how many children he had. They think it's at least 20, but possibly many more. And no one actually knows for sure either, but it's believed that he secretly married his last mistress, Madame de Maintenon.
Well, there's no proof that he did actually marry her, but most historians believe it to be true. She never changed her name, though. It's said that those in the know called her Majesty in private, and she sat in the Queen's place when traveling with the King. That's a sign.
He really did marry her. It was pretty out of character and shows a bit of a hidden side to him because he must have done it for love. And he was only 44 years old when the marriage is said to have taken place after Queen Marie Theresa died in 1683. He could have made another strategic marriage then. He could have grown his power. He could have had more royal children, but he didn't. And he also knew that if he married Madame de Maintenon in open, the nobles would rebel over it. And he'd worked so hard by then to gain control and establish absolute monarchy. Marrying for love would have seemed weak for him, I think. And also, she was of a lesser rank. But it does prove he had a bit of a human side after all.
And as a young man, Louis had a busy social life, and people thought he wouldn't be serious about his responsibilities. So they were surprised when he decided to really take control when Mazarin died. In fact, he was tough as old boots, worked hard, played hard, and was intelligent and cunning. Soon after he took power, he had one of his chief ministers arrested, Nicolas Fouquet, who had built the beautiful castle of Vaux-le-Vicomte near Paris. It was much more beautiful than anything Louis had, so he was not happy about that. The charges of stealing from the king's coffers were most likely made up, but it showed everyone that Louis was not to be trifled with, and it sent a message: no one is more powerful than the King of France.
That was really important to him. He didn't want a repeat of the terrible civil wars that took place during his childhood. He knew that he had to deal with these pesky nobles and the peasants who needed to know he was boss, not the local lords. With the help of his minister, Jean-Baptiste Colbert, he reformed the tax and administration systems of France, which had largely been managed by the nobles who pocketed much of the money. With Colbert's help, much more went to the royal coffers. Colbert was an incredible man. He increased commerce and trade, reduced imports, encouraged manufacturing in all areas from making silk to making cheese, reducing France's reliance on foreign industry. For instance, when France was at war with the Dutch and people still wanted Edam cheese, Louis and Colbert ordered cheesemakers in the north of France to make something like it. And Mimolette was born, though it's quite a different colour and I think a different taste, really. Colbert established regulations of production, new industries, founded the Academy of Sciences, the Paris Observatory, the Royal Academy of Architecture. It was such a golden age. All of this enhanced the reputation of the king. And also, Colbert employed people who weren't nobles to deal with administration. So they were much easier to control and didn't have family loyalty like the nobles did. The money poured in.
But Louis spent it just as fast as he banked it. He thought war after war, his foreign policy and military engagements reshaped European geopolitics, and he expanded France's territory. Louisiana in the US was named in his honor, who claimed it for France in the 1680s.
And did you know it was sold back to the US in 1803 for $15 million? 828,000 square miles of land. Bargain.
Yeah, it is. I want one. Louis had the expensive tastes. One of the ways he controlled the nobility was by moving them to Versailles and away from Paris and their own homes. From a hunting lodge, Louis employed the creators of Vaux-le-Vicomte, the castle that had made him so jealous, to transform the lodge into one of the most beautiful palaces ever built. And we won't talk much about Versailles here, as we've already done a big episode on Versailles a while ago, if you'd like to listen to that. And then he made sure that if anyone wanted to be in favor with him, they lived in the palace and nearby, where he could keep an eye on them. He spied on them, read their letters, and kept them busy.
He certainly did keep them busy. He commissioned loads of cultural and sporting events. And during his reign, his support of the arts was generous. He commissioned hundreds of portraits and busts of himself. He founded the Academie Royale de Danse. He loved to dance, and he was trained actually by professional instructors. And he was very proud of his legs, which were often a main feature in his portraits. He loved ballet. He also founded the Academy of Opera. He employed hundreds of people at Versailles, craftspeople to make ornaments, furniture, mirrors, and other decorative items.
And in Paris, he established a police force, constructed broad boulevards, and installed street lighting. He also constructed Les Invalides, a military complex for soldiers and infirm veterans. He expanded the Louvre and commissioned the Canal du Midi.
He was a busy king, all right. He introduced meticulous routines into the daily lives of people who lived in Versailles, controlling the nobles through a system of rituals, ceremonies, and etiquette, which kept them distracted and kept them from having the time to think about opposing him or causing him trouble. Some of the etiquette rules were actually quite odd. If the king wasn't in residence and you passed his portrait, you had to bow or curtsy to it. And you weren't allowed to knock on his door. Actually, you weren't allowed to knock on any doors in Versailles in case he was in the room. You had to scratch it like a rat so you didn't disturb him too much. And apparently some courtiers grew out one of their fingernails so long they could scratch better. Only Louis and his immediate family could walk through a door without scratching first. You couldn't sit unless you were approved. You had to stay on your feet all day long. And since it was a full-time job getting noticed for being around, it wasn't an easy life for nobles who weren't in with the king.
Nice time. And yeah. Fun fact, every hour of the king's day would be precisely organized, with all the trappings of formality around it. Someone to hand him slippers, someone to empty his chamber pot. Nice job. Two people to take his nightshirt off, someone to untie his neckcloth, someone else to adjust it, someone to hand him a mirror. There were numerous positions for the nobles to know their place. Watching the king perform his lever, waking up and getting dressed ceremony, or coucher, bedtime undressing ceremony, was the highlight of the day for nobles hoping to curry favour with the king.
Louis' day was rigorously organised from morning to night. He started at 8:30 in the morning and was visited by doctors and then friends and nobles who attended him while he washed, combed his hair, shaved, dressed, and maybe had a bowl of soup or a bit of bread dipped in wine for breakfast. And he sometimes drank coffee or hot chocolate. But only important servants were allowed to watch. How many people do you think took part in this ceremony, Ollie?
I'm not sure. Probably 10, 15, maybe.
Nowhere near. It's thought at least 100 people,
wow,
or male, yeah, 100 people in your bedroom taking part in getting the king ready in the morning. Once he was ready, 10 o'clock, he crossed the palace through the Hall of Mirrors, through all those, you know, bling bling rooms to go to mass. And he was followed by crowds of people. After that, he worked on state matters. He famously said, "L'état, c'est moi." The state, it is me, meaning there is no one higher than me in France. Then he usually had lunch in his bedroom in private, a bit of time out. And in the afternoon, he did other things. He had a bit of time out as well, hunting, walking in the garden. Sometimes he did a bit more work or met with his mistresses.
With all the rooms he had lunch in his bedroom.
Yeah. I think he probably just wanted a bit of space, and not to be on show because, wow, we think of, famous celebrities today and paparazzi, but I mean, it was a completely different thing then because even ordinary people could just come to the palace and go and see him. It must have been a crazy life.
That's funny though. And then at 10 o'clock at night, he had dinner, the grand couvert. Nobility would be placed near the king, according to their importance and rank, but to the side of the table so that everyone could have a clear view of Louis. Crowds would watch him eat, they were squeezed in. It was a show of his power. The soup and starters were followed by roasts and salads, then puddings, and finally fruit. With each service, a different procession of officers from the services for the king's mouth brought in dishes in gold, silver, or silver gilt. The best goldsmiths were to produce new forms that would keep the food warm for longer. Glasses, which were ordinary items, were only provided upon request. Despite all this, the meal lasted less than an hour. Surprising.
Incredible. That is incredible. And I love that he had someone called the King's Mouth to take care of his food. And in fact, there were a whopping 324 people involved in preparing the Sun King's meals. Someone to take care of the table, the tablecloth, the bread, someone to take care of the candelabras and the fruit, someone to fold the napkins, which would be made into extraordinary shapes. And as the servants carried the food to the kitchens, they were escorted by guards. And it was etiquette, another rule of etiquette, that if you were walking in Versailles and the food headed for the royal table was carried past you, you had to bow or curtsy to the dish.
And the food must have been cold by then.
Apparently not. Apparently it
No?
wasn't as bad as you think it might be because they kept it on charcoal. Well, it probably wasn't hot, but not stone
Yeah,
cold.
hot
Yeah,
enough.
hot
And the
enough.
king will eat up to 30 different dishes washed down with wine and will pop some candied fruit in his pocket to eat on his way to bed.
Ooh, nibble, nibble. He also liked ice cream a lot. He had two ice houses built at Versailles. The ice was carved out of a frozen pond in winter and stored in the ice houses. Not exactly hygienic, but pretty amazing for the day when he used to serve frozen ice balls on hot days. And in fact, this created a whole new trend as the poorer people got to hear about it, and the practice of mixing cream, ice, and fruit spread. Louis imposed a strict dress code at Versailles, insisting on the finest materials, so the nobles spent a small fortune on outfits trying to outdo each other and impress the king, and bankrupting themselves in the process. But that meant they didn't pay soldiers to cause trouble, so it's another part of his policy. Under him, France became the capital of fashion, etiquette, and culture. The French love of art de la table and art de vivre all stem from the rules that were put in place at Versailles. By the way, we also just did an episode on art de vivre.
Yes, we did. Louis was quite short at 5 feet 4 inches, and that had an impact on the fashion of the day.
Not that short. I'm 4 foot 11 inches. Seems quite tall to me.
Oops, sorry, Janine. Well, as a control freak, he wanted to be taller, so he wore high-heeled shoes up to 5 inches high with buckles and ribbons. Beautiful ribbons, by the way. And he loved red heels for his shoes and made it a rule only he and select aristocrats could wear red heels as well. He made himself taller with big wigs, like really big wigs. He had a room in the palace just for keeping wigs in.
I read that he started to lose his hair quite early, and that partly influenced his choice to wear wigs. And apparently, he had 48 wig makers, and it took around 10 heads of hair to create a single wig. And it's just extraordinary, isn't it? And the rest of European aristocracy were influenced by Louis's love of long, flowing locks in his wig. And the term bigwig was coined in England. We still use that phrase to this day to mean an important person.
And did you know that one of the king's favorite wig makers once said he was prepared to strip the heads of every French subject to cover that of the king?
Nice. Not. Despite his long life and long reign, Louis holds the record for the longest reigning monarch in the history of France, 72 years on the throne. But he didn't always enjoy the best of health. His doctors noted symptoms of diabetes, chronic inflammation, dental abscesses, boils, fainting spells, gout, dizziness, hot flushes, and headaches. And as he drew towards the end of his life, he was in almost permanent pain. He had terrible gangrene in his leg, but he outlived all of his immediate family, including his surviving legitimate son. His legitimate grandsons also died, meaning his heir was his 5-year-old great grandson, Louis, the Duke of Anjou, who coincidentally was to have the second longest reign in French history.
And Louis XIV died in 1715, and his body was displayed for 8 days at the palace before being transported to the Basilica of Saint-Denis, north of Paris, last resting place of French kings and queens. His death marked the end of an era, but the legacy of the Sun King, Le Roi Soleil, lives on. Versailles stands as a monument to his reign, and his policies continue to influence French national identity today. We've journeyed through the life of a king whose reign epitomized the age of absolutism, leaving a mark on history that endures to this day. But now, it's time for a reader's question. Got a question about France? Well, ask the experts. We reply to you in each episode. And we do it for free. Okay, so Janine, what's today's question?
Today's question is from Simon Parker of Ontario, Canada, and he asks, who do you think is the most Frenchest person ever? I think that's a really hard question, but it is actually a surprisingly common question that people ask. And I guess there are a lot of potential answers. I mean, Louis XIV, for instance, could be the Frenchest person, you know. But Ollie, since you are the Frenchest person on this podcast team, this is one for you to answer.
Well, it is a difficult question to answer indeed, but the first person who comes to my mind is the late, great Serge Gainsbourg. He liked the ladies, he was into the arts, of course, a great singer, and wrote saucy songs with French still love. He drank a lot, he smoked a bit old school these days, he dated Brigitte Bardot, come on, and wrote the infamous song Je t'aime moi non plus for her, which she sang with him originally, but then remembered she was married and refused to allow it to be released. Jane Birkin sang it instead. And his irreverent side alone makes him seem very French to me. But to be frank, I might be somewhat biased because I pretty much love everything he does.
I love that, Brigitte Bardot remembered she was married and refused to allow the song to be released, like you do. Yeah, he was pretty wild. He doesn't come across as being a particularly nice man at times, and he was very badly behaved. But yeah, I agree. He was very French, at least for those days. And I think for me, I would have to choose Victor Hugo. He was the most wonderful writer, and I think he really understood human nature. He's widely quoted to this day, almost 200 years after he died. And one of my favourite quotes, and something that my next door neighbour taught me, she's 94 and she loves to quote the writers of France, and she taught me this one, which is, "Even after the darkest night, the sun will always rise." I just love that. And he also said, "To love and have loved, that is enough. Ask nothing further. There is no other pearl to be found in the dark folds of life." They're quite simple words. I mean, there's nothing big or clever about the words, but it's the way he puts them together, and there's such beauty in them. So for me, he's my Frenchest man or Frenchest person.
Yes, I agree, Janine. Victor Hugo is definitely very French too. And obviously a big part of French culture as well. Thanks so much for that question, Simon. If anyone has a question for us, feel free to send it to janine@thegoodlifefrance.com or via our podcast newsletter. And if there is a topic you want to know more about, just let us know. This is the Good Life France podcast. Oh là là! Le podcast The Good Life France.
Thank you so much, everyone. A huge merci beaucoup to everyone for listening to our podcast from all around the world. And an enormous thank you for sharing the podcast with your friends and family. We're so grateful to you for that.
Yes, we are. You've been listening to Janine March and me, Olivier Geoffrey. You can find me at parischanson.fr.
And you can find me and heaps of information about France, where to visit, culture, history, recipes, everything France, at thegoodlifefrance.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast, my weekly newsletter about France, and our totally brilliant, totally free magazine, which you can read at magazine.thegoodlifefrance.com. But for now, it's au revoir from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
Speak to you soon.
The Good Life France podcast. Available on all podcast platforms, on thegoodlifefrance.com and on parischanson.fr. The most beautiful French songs of the 40s, 50s and 60s, only on Paris Chanson. Available on your mobile, smart TV, computer and smart speaker 24/7. Visit parischanson.fr to find out more. That's parischanson.fr.